Okay, item 9, presentation from staff and DLJ regarding potential commitment to DLJ real estate. Tim Price.
You all have a memo before you recommending a $50 million commitment to DLJ Fund 6. I'll just provide a little bit of background about what we're hoping to achieve with this and about the partnership with DLJ. DLJ has been in our lineup since Fund 1, so this would be the sixth time we have committed to them if the board opts to commit today. They do pursue opportunistic real estate. They focus on three cities. When we say opportunistic, we're talking development for the most part and heavy repositioning. So this is the type of real estate where we might be taking raw land and going vertical with this or doing heavy repositioning. So as opposed to value add real estate, which we talked about the last board meeting, which is more of a lighter touch, lighter repositioning, this is the big heavy lifting. DLJ is focused on emerging neighborhoods in three cities, and that's important because we take a look at the real estate cycle and say, given the maturity point we see in commercial real estate in the United States, the inexpensive properties that you can buy and reposition easily, those opportunity sets are largely past us now. So we're saying we need to be lowering our return assumptions and looking for unique opportunity sets. And the fact that DLJ focuses on emerging neighborhoods in only three cities gives us comfort that that level of focus is there. The three cities they focus on currently are Boston, New York, and Los Angeles, and particular neighborhoods inside those cities. DLJ has been, as I mentioned, around since late 90s, first as part of Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette, then as part of Credit Suisse for most of the 2000s, and now as an independent firm. Fund 5, their most recent fund, it was their first fund as an independent firm and followed a similar investment strategy to Fund 6 that we're looking at here. Focused on a couple of neighborhoods in a couple of cities and with a smaller investment footprint. You'll note in the memo, funds 3 and 4 got to be rather large under the Credit Suisse umbrella, in excess of $1 billion, and they were global funds. There were investments in China, Japan, India, the UK. That's largely a remnant of the past now. We're focused on three US cities here. We have had a long-term partnership with DLJ, and as we look forward in the opportunistic real estate space, the target allocation has come down considerably from where we were 4 or 5 years ago. We have a 4% target allocation, which means we only have about $150 million in available commitments within this space. The other partners we have in this space have largely migrated out of the opportunistic space and towards value add, those being Angelo Gordon and Oaktree. So among our existing partners, DLJ is the one who's maintaining the opportunistic focus, and our preference is to maintain the partnerships with long-term partners, rather than go out and expand into new relationships at this point in time, given our smaller footprint in this space. We have partners Andy Rifkin and Carmine Finelli here. Before we bring them in, obviously want to provide a forum for the trustees to ask any questions regarding the recommendation.
And when we give you the authority, I believe, to $100 million, so why are we not this bad? I'm just wondering why this is brought to the board.
Yeah, so we have existing relationships with them that exceed that $100 million. We have about $140 million in current commitments, and the way the language reads, it's perspective and current commitment. So this would exceed that $100 million threshold.
This is more my understanding of our two key reasons. And by and large, it looks fine to me, but on the front page, number one, Cicera remains constructive. And then we drop down to two, a focused mandate as an independent investment boutique. I guess that one's a little more clear, but remains constructive.
Remains constructive on the opportunistic real estate space. So we missed a couple words there, but yes, in the opportunistic real estate space, the board has reaffirmed a 4% allocation earlier this year to opportunistic real estate. It's smaller than what we've had in the past. We did a lot more of this in 2009, 2010, 2011, coming out of the global financial crisis when, candidly, properties were cheaper, easier to obtain, and the fact that we had long-term patient capital was a competitive advantage. So we tilted into the space. We tilted away from the space, but we still remain constructive on it, just at a smaller strategic allocation. The independent investment boutique, this is recognizing that DLJ has, for most of its history, been part of larger organizations. We think now that they became independent in the past couple of years, they spun out of Credit Suisse, they're wholly owned, wholly owned by the partners, investment boutique, that level of focus lends itself to execution on the smaller platform that they have now. So, you know, smaller focus on number of cities, smaller focus on number of neighborhoods, and they take a very high-touch approach to each individual property. We think that plays to their strengths.
Okay.
Jim, there are 150 basis points is their fee, correct?
Yes.
How does that compare to Angelo Gordon's fee? What is Angelo Gordon's fee in that same area?
It's in the same neighborhood. I'd have to go back and double-check the exact number.
Are they less, like 1.25 or 125, or are they more?
You have I would want to go back and check, but okay. 150 is kind of relatively standard within this space for opportunistic real estate. Yeah.
Okay. What I worry about is there's I mean, I like what I've read. I really like it, and I know it fits with our investment portfolio. But I worry about the interest rates going up and how that affects their leverage. I mean, if they're going to be borrowing a lot of money, it's and I'm sure they take all that into account. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing and making money at it. But it, by the same token, we're in an area of time when it seems standard to keep raising the interest rate. And so I worry about that with this kind of investment. Yeah. How do you feel about it?
I think we share your concerns that that is going to be a negative or it's going to be a drag on performance going forward. I think, you know, when we bring Andy and Carmine in, that's a perfect question to pose to them, how they take that into their underwriting, because they do incorporate a rising rate environment into their underwriting here. All the debt that they take on is, you know, on a property-specific basis, so the property property's development lifecycle has to support that debt, including any potential rate rises, because by and large, these are floating rate pieces of debt on a real estate development deal. But that's incorporated into their initial underwriting. And so they basically lower return expectations, assuming that the rates will rise during their hold period.
And their lower rates are still within our acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, they talk about an 18% targeted IRR. We internally underwrite to a significantly lower number, but we're comfortable that it's been incorporated properly.
18% is high. Okay. I also thank you for doing the bios on both of these guys. And I'm presuming Carmen is male or female?
Yeah, male.
Okay.
Carmen. So Carmen and Andy have worked together the entire relationship or the entire history of DLJ. And, you know, so this will be fun six. So Andy and Carmen have kind of owned the Cicera relationship for that entire 20-plus year history. So
great. And their qualifications were dead down as well, especially the warden. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to point out that Gabe and I had the pleasure of attending the DLJ client conference in June, I think it was.
Yeah.
June or July. The months are swinging by. And I think I reported out after that, but I did want to say that I was certainly impressed with the folks that presented, the quality of the people on DOJ's team, and the rigor that goes into the analysis of the individual investments. It was a fascinating peek behind the curtain. I won't say anything more in the public session, but it was a fascinating peek about how they go about what they do and the level of detail and expertise that goes into each stage. It was impressive. So I'll be interested to see how Andy and Carmine go, certainly present today, but at least from my perspective,
I agree,
you might want to comment. Yeah, it's a quality firm.
Anything else for Tim?
Okay. You want to go ahead and bring Andy and Carmine in.
How are we looking at 50?
Yeah, that's the one.
Are you looking at 50 now?
Hi. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
I recognize you.
My name is Andy Ripkin. I'm with DLJ Real Estate Capital Partners, and my partner, Carmine Finelli.
Well, welcome. The floor is yours.
Oh, great. I'm hoping this will be the high point of the morning.
The phone hasn't been good to you.
Anyway, it's. I was thinking that the first time I came here, I didn't have any gray hair at all, so look what you've done to me.
And I have a lot more.
I have all hair.
Yeah. So, look, we've known Contra Costa County for a long time. You know, we've worked with you for many years, and, you know, we're very happy to be back here and sort of talk to you about our latest fund. You know, DLJ Real Estate Capital Partners has, you know, we've been around for a while. I think we're on our 23rd or 24th year. We've sort of learned a lot for those 25 years, and I think, you know, we're very excited about sort of our recent fund, Fund 5, which, you know, has performed well, and we're very excited about this new fund that we're kicking off, which is, you know, RECP 6. This is a fund that we're targeting about $300 million, and I think what's very important is to really sort of focus on sort of what we're doing, what we sort of think is the opportunity. We have, over the years, really refined our strategy in terms of what we're looking at and the types of deals that we do. And the one thing that we, you know, sort of feel very strongly about is that, you know, the majority of growth, you know, real estate growth in the United States is really happening in the urban centers. You know, it's sort of undeniable when you sort of look at sort of all these statistics. And as a result of that, we've sort of focused on sort of those urban centers that we sort of, one, that we know, that we either grew up in, live in today, and that are also sort of benefiting from a lot of the significant growth. And I think with RECP 5 and with RECP 6, we're going to continue to focus on sort of three major centers: New York City, Boston, Massachusetts, and Los Angeles. Obviously, New York and Los Angeles, I think you hear a lot about, major cities, important cities. You probably don't hear as much about Boston. And I would tell you, we've had some great success in Boston. I'll just make a quick note, just a couple of comments on Boston. I think the world has changed a lot over the years. You know, years ago, you would sort of graduate from college and sort of go get a job wherever the employer was. I remember sort of big companies, you know, sort of, I'll date myself when I'll talk about big companies like IBM, where you would sort of pick up and go and work for IBM wherever they were. And they weren't in such great locations. Today it's completely changed. These kids have changed things. You know, they want to live in certain places. They want certain lifestyle. And I think employers today have recognized that they've got to go where the talent is. And I think that when you think about Boston and think about sort of the universities in Boston, you know, whether it be Tufts or MIT or Harvard and what's happening there, there's enormous amount of intellectual power there. And as a result of that, you know, the companies that are literally flooding into Boston right now to capture that piece of talent is incredible. And I think we've certainly benefited from that. So we certainly, you know, just a quick comment on Boston, because I think New York and LA are pretty clear to a lot of people. You know, I think the next level, because I'm sure you've thought about real estate, and you've thought about real estate in New York and LA. The next thing that we focused on is sort of what happens in these cities. How do people sort of go from one place to another? You know, you sort of hear about different parts of, you know, whether San Francisco or New York, where it's, oh my God, rents are so expensive, and how do people afford to live there? Well, rents do get expensive, and people don't afford there, they move someplace else. They don't move to Chicago, they just move to a different neighborhood. The big shift that we saw, and it's a very funny dynamic. I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, so I'm a Brooklyn boy. We lived in Brooklyn because my parents couldn't afford to live in Manhattan, so we were in Brooklyn. And what you saw happening, and as you saw happening was a lot of people, as Manhattan got too expensive, people were moving to Brooklyn. Well, a lot of people moved to Brooklyn. I think Brooklyn is the fourth largest city in the country right now. And what happened as these people moved to Brooklyn is, you know, with them, sort of office buildings started to sort of get established in Brooklyn, restaurants, entertainment, apartment buildings. And now Brooklyn has sort of become sort of a major population center. In fact, in some ways, Brooklyn has become more expensive than Manhattan. And we sort of observe that. And what we focus on is let's sort of, you know, we love these great cities. We love New York. We love LA. We love Boston. But now let's sort of look deeper in these cities and let's sort of think about sort of what's the migratory path in these cities? What neighborhoods are people moving to? And I think the skill set that we've developed, and I think it's a skill set that we've had for many, many years, is being able to identify what we call emerging neighborhoods. What are the early signs? You know, what, you know, where will people want to be? Unfortunately, you know, look, we're trying to generate high returns. You know, we're targeting high teens, 18, 20% returns. To generate returns, you've got to be, you can't be doing what everybody else is doing. You've got to be doing something a little different. You've got to be ahead of the curve. And that's really our focus, is to really identify these emerging areas in these very important cities and then leverage on the growth that ensues after that. And I think what's great for us is, you know, we're a relatively small company. We're not, you know, we're targeting to raise $300 or $350 million. We're not raising billions. It allows us to do relatively small and modest deals, which is perfect for these emerging neighborhoods. So in a lot of ways, you know, our capabilities, our skill set, you know, our capital base and our strategy line up well. And I think you've really seen it come together in Fund 5, where, you know, we've identified a series of deals in those cities that have performed extremely well. And I'm happy to say, I think despite the fact that things feel like there's been a lot of growth, you know, we still see a lot of opportunity in those key markets, you know, particularly Boston and LA. I think New York is a bit expensive. You know, we're doing less in New York City than we are doing in Brooklyn today. You know, I do expect that we may push out to Queens at some point as we sort of track sort of transportation lines and where people are moving. But, you know, I do feel like there's still really terrific opportunities in these major centers, and that's really what we're focused Fund 6 on. You know, in terms of our investment platform, you know, we've got, you know, we're very, very, I mean, you know, we could talk to Tim and Chi-Chi, we're very hands-on. I mean, very. We're at our properties, you know, daily. We're focused on the most minute details. We just opened up an apartment complex in Los Angeles, just opened it a couple of days ago. And I sort of went in there, I was looking around, and the guy who's sort of managing it day-to-day says, how do you like this scent? I said, what? How do you like this scent? You know, it's citrus. I mean, it's like, what? No, it's like, yeah. And it was like really had me focus. I say, wow, you know, it really does smell good in here. You know, so, you know, so I will even add to our investment platform, we're focused on cents, dollars and cents, no pun intended. So I do think, you know, it is a focus and it's something that we're very proud of. We're not sort of handing off our projects to other people to build for us. We are sort of super hands-on. And you know, I'm sort of quite proud that I think what we offer, the projects that we offer, both in terms of the quality and the durability, but also sort of the aesthetics, the feeling, the vibrations that come from these projects, I think are sort of second to none. So we're quite happy about that.
One of the things that's interesting is if you went back and even thought about it 5 years ago, but clearly 10 years ago, you would never be thinking about real estate from the perspective of the end user experience. And part of what these companies are going to the real estate for is a recruitment tool. Part of what you're doing in a residential building is making sure that people have a really great experience in the real estate. And whether it's social media or other aspects have all played into that, but being dead focused on the end user experience has really allowed our properties to get top of the market rents. When we go to sell, we tend to get premium pricing. You know, making sure that level of excellence in the execution there. And I think people are becoming much more discerning in the use of real estate as opposed to having commodity real estate. They want to have something that has a great experience. And that's kind of what's motivating people to move into these neighborhoods. So it all plays together in terms of strategy.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that's sort of, you know, that's sort of the basic strategy. You know, Carmine, maybe you want to sort of take a moment and just talk a little bit about sort of, you know, our business plan and how we sort of run our, you know, sort of the day-to-day.
So some of what's going on from a, growing this business in this strategy is making sure that you've got a network of the right relationships. And it is a kind of, Andy and I kind of divide of working in the business. Andy's clearly on the creative side, has a great network with whether it's the architects, the designers, the aesthetic, the placemakers, people that are in the social know. You know, having that network of people in each of our three cities allows us to have a pretty good read of what areas are getting hot, what areas are not, what things are overdone, so on and so forth. Really focused on that. I have more of the, you know, the legal, the accounting, the reporting background. So more of, hey, listen, we've got large pension plans as our investors. We have to have reporting. We have to have compliance. So there is definitely a partnership here that works at different levels in the business. But I think having that combination has always been something that kind of works well for us. Look, in terms of the actual delivery of the product, I think Andy's built out a great network of people that we work with to make sure that we're delivering excellent quality products and we're making sure that we're selling them in a diligent way to, you know, execute the
You know, I would say, I would normally sort of add a character for me to be complimentary to Carmine, but...
We've worked together for 26 years. It's a little bit like
that's all.
You know, to me, it's sort of like
marriages.
You know, for me, I sort of look. I have a great job. I love my job, and I deal with amazing people, and we do great projects. But it really, it's still real estate, and it's still very detail oriented. And there's volumes of documents behind these, and I have never met anybody that can go through a document like Carmine Finelli and protect all of us. I mean, this is a guy who reads every word and the placement of every comma to sort of figure out sort of what can go wrong. And without that brain behind, you know, sort of the fun part of the business, we wouldn't be in this position. So I, you know, I don't yeah. underestimate sort of your contribution to this because we couldn't have done it without you. So I think it's really important. And I think that combination, you know, we're, you know, we're sort of dealing, you know, we're trying to sort of make places, you know, we're trying to find new areas. And I think that is an effort, and that does require sort of a lot of thinking and thought and a lot of support. You know, this project that we just opened, we were very fortunate to work with a top design firm in Los Angeles, maybe the top, you know, group called Commune Design, who has just sort of hit a stride. And I've been friendly with those guys who started that business for years, and we had some problems. You know, there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing on this recent project, and there was a lot of some changes in the middle that, you know, weren't costly, but just, you know, redefining some things as the markets change and as we sort of looked at competitive properties. And Stephen Johankinette, who sort of runs the business, who is, you know, truly a genius, basically, God, you know, it's like, this really turned out great. And in fact, several of my employees want to live here, you know, which has never happened to us before, you know, and I think that was a great, you know, that was a great tribute. And I think it's a, you know, it's just important that we can continue to sort of bring in these young people, these creative people who can help us, you know, pioneer, be pioneering in these new locations. So I'm very excited about that as well.
We have a page in here that has a little bit of the history. We were at two larger financial institutions before we brought the business back in 2010. We still manage the tail end of the legacy of those funds, but clearly this fund is designed to be just a replica of the Fund 5 fund, which is three markets, New York, Boston, LA, emerging neighborhoods, hands-on real estate. So it's a very... The other funds were truly opportunistic in ways. They would react to an opportunity and do an opportunity almost geographically agnostic. In this situation, we pick neighborhoods, we start at the neighborhood, and then figure out what deals can be done in the neighborhood, very much from a strategy-driven investment philosophy rather than an opportunity-driven.
Question. Given where we are in the market cycle, what do you think is the biggest single risk that you face going forward as you plot out and look at additional investment?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. Frankly, I think a lot of, you know, underlying a lot of what we're doing is technology. And I think if we were to have a major technology meltdown, like we had in the, I guess, sort of, what was it, the early 2000s, I think that would sort of cause a hiccup for us. I don't think our buildings would empty. I just think growth would slow. But the reason I say that, and I, you know, unfortunately, I think I'm speaking more broadly, and I'm not a sophisticated economic kind of guy, but you know, the world has become so concentrated on three or four companies, you know, Google, Apple, Amazon, you know, that, you know, if all of a sudden we figured out how to live our lives without those companies, and I don't know if that, you know, that's the difference, you know. Because in the early 2000s, it was eyeballs and that all that stuff. Today, we're using it. Today, we've become sort of dependent on it. And if I said to you, okay, just hand me all your iPhones, yeah, you may sort of be relieved for about an hour because you don't have to sort of look at it. But by the time you got home at night and you couldn't order your food, you couldn't do Uber or you couldn't get your Amazon, you may sort of say, hey, I'm not so happy. But I think the thing that I think about is our dependency on technology, because in some way it's impacting a lot of the growth that we're seeing in these great cities.
At the end of the day, this is a people business, and the fact that those companies, who they're attracting, the people that they're attracting, those are the people that are using a lot of our real estate. Thinking about our neighborhoods, that's where we are.
Carmine, I have the same question for you. You gave me a social answer, which give me a nuts and bolts figures, mathematical figures answer that you have to deal with or you think is going to be the toughest thing.
So, for example, I'm looking at our project in Culver City. Our project in Culver City has become a main and main location. We bought it as a parking lot from a Bank of the West, and we're going to go build a building that's 12,000 square feet of retail, 50,000 square feet of office. What makes the thing work is that Apple is right down the street with their entertainment offices. You've got Netflix down the street on the other side. And who's the other one that's just moved in there?
Amazon
moved. So, and so now you take a look at that location and you said, all of these, and their budgets go crazy, right? Like Netflix went from a $3 billion budget at the beginning of the year on their entertainment venues up to 13 in the middle of the year, right? So they're hiring people like gangbusters. They're taking up space like gangbusters. A lot of the tenants who are coming to our space are taking up, they're like a secondary sound engineers and video post production types of people that are taking up space in our buildings. If that turned off like that, that's a big feeder into our business. And so we kind of look at those types of opportunities and go, who's in these neighborhoods? Where are these technologies? What are they doing? Where are they in their cycle? Not so focused on what their stock price is. I don't think that has an impact on us. And that may be a totally separate conversation. But it's a people business that's driving this.
And I've got one other question for you.
Sure.
In the light of interest rates raising and continuing to raise, what are you guys doing that's going to keep the IRR at 18 and 20% around that issue?
So I spent a lot of time going through cap rates and interest rates. So cap rates is the real estate tends to trade on cap rates. So you divide the income by the cap rates. It's very correlated to interest rates. And the common theory is if interest rates go up, cap rates go up. And that may be true if you look at the market as a total. The complexity becomes when you actually dive down and figure out what's really happening at any given property level. What you find is that the correlation between cap rates and interest rates isn't as good as people. The story is better than the actual data. What is very strong, however, is the correlation between interest rates, growth rates, rental growth rates, and cap rates. If you're in a building that you've been able to push rents 50 cents or a dollar in the last 2 years, you're going to experience a low cap rate because the buyer coming in is going to believe he can push rents. If you're in a market that you're seeing rents plateau or even dip, cap rates are going to move out because the buyer is going to underwrite the same thing. So it's much more a focus of figuring out when we're coming into these markets, where are rents going and where did we leave rents? Did we leave rents with enough for the next buyer to have a little bit of bite? And if you look at from a pure cap rate perspective, you know, markets like, for example, we just sold our building, the Taft building, which is at the corner of Hollywood and Vine in Los Angeles. We bought it $2 a foot rents. We did our renovation. We were pushing $4 to $4.50 a foot in rents. We sold it to a very well-known value-add fund, multiples our size. And their view was, if you looked over the last 2-3 years, it was 10% plus growth. There's not many markets in the country that have got double-digit growth. Even if it gets the modest single-digit growth, we can still make our returns work. It's growth of rents that I think are much more correlated. A 25, 50 basis point change in their financing cost,
so that,
and changing their view.
So that for you, that's the counter to the increase in
right.
In
now, if you're buying CBD core office buildings that are 20-year rented, then your price sensitivity to interest rates is complete. It's a different mathematics than the business that we're in.
But I think you should talk a little bit, Carmine, because again, maybe sort of the answer would be sort of between the nuts and bolts and the social is we're dependent on growth, and without growth, things change.
Yeah.
I think we've also, because we've been doing this for a long time, we've seen some cycles where we've, where we didn't have that growth. And I think where we have been very careful, in terms of constructing our portfolio, is we've been very careful with our use of leverage. And as a result of that, I think what has really sort of saved us in a number of situations is, we never had a gun to our head to sell.
Pardon me, come again?
We never had a gun to our head in terms of having to sell a building at the wrong time and have been able to sort of wait for the cycles to pick back up. So I think it's just a way to hedge, should sort of that growth dip off.
Okay.
If you look at a handful of like the New York City families who have been in real estate for generations and generations, their formula typically is they'll buy a good quality building, they'll put low leverage on it, and they'll own it for forever. And with the mindset of saying, if the market's hit a dip, yeah, maybe the value goes down, but you just have to wait it out. Whereas if you start putting 75-85% leverage on these things, markets hit a dip, you have, the proverbial
gun to your head. A lot of homeowners went through that a while back.
Yeah. And we haven't created our returns based on leverage.
One of the things that strikes me, LA is one of your three cities. California, from my observations anyway, rents are increasing in no small part because it is so hard to build. And what is being built for a relatively small layer of well-to-do folks and well-to-do companies. Should that change, I have no real sense that it is, but should it change, I would think that would change the formula you're looking at, particularly for L.A. Is that something you spend any time on? Have any thoughts? And I have another question that's just of general interest. This group, obviously, we live in the Bay Area. Bay Area is in the middle of the kind of world that you're talking about. Obviously,
center of it.
Those FANG stocks are, for the most part, headquartered here. Where is growth coming in the Bay Area in terms of real estate values, to the extent that you might have any knowledge on that?
It's interesting. I can't really speak to the Bay Area. I think of all the markets that I feel like it has been, extraordinarily difficult and sort of, very toppy, it's been the Bay Area. And, we did one deal here, we're about to trade out of it, and realized that there was just not enough room for us. And look, I think one of the benefits that LA has had is that the Bay Area has gotten so expensive. And if you look at the amount of technology companies that have been sort of moving down to Los Angeles, it's remarkable. And again, just cost of housing, and cost of office rents, it's just hard to do anything here. So I don't think I'm not the right guy to make a comment about the Bay Area. On the LA point,
I think it's a very fair comment. One of the things that makes LA an attractive market, one of the things that makes California generally an attractive market, but LA specifically, is it's huge barriers to entry in terms of getting stuff built. New York has got a scarcity of land, which creates a barrier to entry. Boston's got its own situations that create some scarcity. LA's, the planning process represents a hurdle that creates a barriers to entry. So if you've got a good piece of real estate, you can benefit in markets where there's a bit of compression and you can enjoy some rental rate growth. In markets that don't have that, I think about like a Houston or other places with a far easier planning regime, you get these windows where they're very, very hot, and then every developer gets the same idea. They put up more buildings, the markets get oversaturated, they go back down through a cycle, and you continue through. LA's a bear to get something approved. San Francisco's not much better, and I think that does create a natural barrier to entry here that is, from a real estate perspective, an interesting thing. Now, you have to be patient. Like, for example, our Culver City thing took longer than we expected to get through the approval process, and that's not unusual in California. You have to, you know, kind of work your way through it.
I'm not sure I was answering your question, though.
Carmen, yeah, sort of. Do you see any sign of this changing? That was sort of
that they're going to make it easier.
Exactly.
Right.
Certainly a lot of discussion about making it, leave the it open, easier to build more.
Just honestly, I can only sort of speak over the 20 years I've been doing this. It's only gotten harder. You know, particularly as sort of people sort of, you know, as now you start to bring in sort of environmental sensitivities, quality of life sensitivities, noise, air, and I just have not seen, there's not been one sign where it's gotten easier. It's only gotten harder. And there's also, you know, there's also just less space. And there's traffic issues and traffic, you know, think about just, you know, one of the things that we always have to deal with is these EI, environmental impact reports on any project we're doing. And those EIRs always come down to traffic. And, you know, maybe, you know, look, maybe when we have automated cars, self-driving cars, and traffic and things like that ease because of that, maybe that whole traffic component of building buildings, I'm just making it gets easier. I don't think it's a Fund 6 issue. I think it's, you know, I don't think it's going to happen.
Fund 26 issue.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't see it getting easier. If in fact it did get easier, I think we're, you know, if it got easier to build things and do things, I think it would only benefit for us. It would be a benefit for us. It would just make our time, you know, it would make our cycle quicker. We'd be able to sort of do projects faster, bring them to market. But I do think that part of what makes LA and New York and the Bay Area and some of these great cities so great is that they do have a real sense of control, and they really do focus, you know, these neighborhood boards that get involved in all these projects, they really focus on maintaining a lifestyle and a quality of life. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, it's been a really good thing for us because, you know, when we go and invest in something, we know that nobody's going to sort of spoil the neighborhood down the block. And I just don't see that sort of self-interest changing. I think these, you know, activated communities are just going to continue to protect these areas, and the more protection, the more difficulty to build. That would be my sense of it.
So that leads me to another question. In your past experience, have you ever had a property that developed an environmental issue after you purchased and developed it? And so that's the first question. Have you ever had that happen to you?
Like environmental in terms of like pollution?
Like, well, you buy the property that's got a building existing on it, and 2 years later you discover there was a gas station a block away that
I can't think of a single leaked,
and you have dirt or you
contamination.
We have bought tainted properties and cleaned them up, but we bought them knowingly.
Right.
We have never been in a situation where, I mean, we have a very heavy front end diligence program. We have a particular person in our organization. This is a woman whose name is Pam Callen, who is masterful at dealing
with
this.
That does all that for you.
I mean, this woman, she's a little crazy, but I mean, she like sits in a closet and just looks at documents. But, you know, we bought them knowingly and we've cleaned them up. We have never been in a situation where we sort of said, oh, didn't you know there was a gas station up the block? And we haven't been in that situation. Thank God. You know,
all right.
Thank God. But we have, you know, we have cleaned up. We've had monitoring wells. We've sort of, you know,
you're building an urban location, so that is a little bit of par for the course. Mm-hmm. That's part of the underwriting.
Soil samples and
soil samples, monitoring wells, venting systems, blah 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 blah.
Yep. And look, sometimes you have to, you know, who wants to, but I wouldn't say that. Oh, we won't do it because, you know, I mean, you know, a lot of the stuff is, you know, it's a matter of taking out some soils. Tanks, you know, sort of, you know, the groundwater stuff is where it gets tricky, and that's where we're sort of, you know, sort of only so much, you know, bioremediation that will happen, and it is monitoring wells.
should we do it? I think.
Okay, sorry.
You want to move to a case?
I was just in the interest of time, maybe we could talk about pipeline.
You know what? No more groundwater contamination.
More groundwater contamination.
Okay. maybe I'll kick off pipeline. So the first deal on page 8 is the first deal we did in Fund 5 was in the Dumbo neighborhood in Brooklyn. And with a partner called Alloy Development. And Alloy came back to us with a building that is about a block and a half from the first one we did in Dumbo with those guys. This is a 46-unit. This is a conversion of an existing pair of buildings into 46 condo units. In the Dumbo is a neighborhood in Brooklyn. It's an abbreviation for Down Under the Manhattan Bridge Overpass. It does not have anything to do with the Disney character. But it is one of the, it's interesting how the world in New York has shifted from now you're looking at buildings and saying, what is your proximity to a handful of New York, Brooklyn neighborhoods? When we did the first deal in Dumbo, we said, gee, what's the discount of this price relative to apartments in New York? And now Dumbo is its own neighborhood. Super and this hot. Is a super, super hot neighborhood in New York City. So it's with an existing partner. It's a block and a half away from a deal that we exited, you know, like 2 years ago. So it's certainly something we're very interested in looking at.
Yeah, I think the next deal, and again, this is, we have a pipeline. There's a few deals in Brooklyn. There's a couple of deals in Boston that are sort of, you know about to sort of move forward, as we close this fund. The next deal is a deal in Williamsburg. You know, people, you know, if you hear about Brooklyn, you probably have heard about Williamsburg. This is sort of an interesting strategy. Part of the strategy associated, you know, with this is the building on the lower left. We didn't put addresses and things for these buildings just because, you know, this is all public information and we didn't want our competitors to know what we were doing. But this is a building, it's a gorgeous loft building. It's exactly what everybody wants when they think about living in a sort of a cool industrial neighborhood in Brooklyn. The challenge here is sort of dealing with some residential tenants that need to be essentially vacated. It's sort of artists that sort of have ultimately sort of claimed housing there. Most of it is, I would sort of say, 75% illegal. And we've had some great experience and great success in sort of working with these tenants. And it's not just a matter of evicting. It's really working with them, bringing the building into legal compliance, and then just resetting the rents so that it's, you know, it's market rents. I think part of the strategy here is really, in some ways, is a contrarian play, right? There's something big happening in Brooklyn right now. The major subway line that sort of connects Manhattan to Brooklyn is called the L train. So if you Google the L train, people will talk about the L train. The L train went through a lot of damage based on, what was the name of that? On Hurricane Sandy. It never, the tunnels never got repaired. So New York MTA has now said, hey, we're shutting down the L train. So that's like, wow, you know, how do we get there? There's some very interesting solutions that are people thinking about, like floating bridges across the, you know, like pontoon bridges and things for bicycles, but who knows how they'll work out. But essentially, you know, what we're sort of seeing is people are starting to migrate away from Williamsburg in anticipation of this transportation slowdown. We believe that the fact that people are migrating away from Brooklyn will actually give us an opportunity to vacate this building because it will be, quote, less attractive. And then as soon as we're done with the rehabilitation, L train, there's no doubt the L train will definitely run again, the tubes will be fixed, there will be an L train, and when that sort of comes back into service, we think this is a super prime piece of real estate. So that's, you know, another deal that we're working on that we
can. Question for you, how do you deal with the rent control in New York? I mean,
there's very little you can do. I mean, there's rent stabilization, there's rent control. This is not rent control, this is something called IMD. This was sort of artists that took residence, which is different. With rent control, you know, very often you're sort of talking to tenants and offering them buyouts, or you're just sitting there. We've got a couple of buildings in some early funds where we've had rent control tenants for the last 13 years, and you basically rent around them.
You underwrite that they're going to stay there forever. I mean,
educate me. So you buy a renter out. Does that mean that a new renter comes in at a rate that you?
Yes.
And that's within the framework of rent control.
Yes.
Don't you got to leave it empty for a while? You have to leave the apartment vacant?
No, it's not. California has this, I know we're sort of dealing with this at a property where the renter has the opportunity to come back in at a new rent. That's not the way New York works. That once you vacate a tenant and they release the unit, you're free to rent it at market rent. So you don't have that latency period. I think it's like, 24 months. I know in LA we're dealing with a project now where we had a tenant, and now they're coming back and saying, hey, we want to rent it again. We don't have that.
Yeah, IMD is a little bit different. This is a situation where people put up mezzanines and carve out bedrooms that really aren't legal bedrooms in the city of New York and stuff like that. So you've got a whole bunch of code issues.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is this is sort of A-plus location in Williamsburg, and it's an A-plus building. I mean, it's an A-plus building as it relates to sort of an amazing warehouse building. And if you're sort of a young professional living in Brooklyn, this is the kind of accommodation that you're looking for.
When you see an issue like with the L train, your competitors think the same like you are. How are you dealing with that kind of thing with competitors out there?
Look, you know, we have a lot of competitors, and there's a lot of really smart people, and I'm sure they think the same way. I know it's going to sound crazy, but over the 20 years we've been doing this, I think we've developed, you know, really positive reputations as being very honorable buyers, you know, honorable sellers, honorable landlords. I think people really want to work with us. I think a lot of our competitors are, a lot of our competitors are really big and they don't want to do small deals, so that helps, you know. So we tend to be competing with, but also more local guys. These local guys, one, they're not as well financed. You know, we have a fund behind us, so we can move quickly. We could sort of, you know, speak with certainty. And, you know, again, a very positive reputation in terms of really, you know, if a buyer has a choice of, hey, I want to sell it to DLJ or, you know, Joe Bloggs, I mean, very often they'll come to us based on sort of our reputation. And then, you know, sometimes we lose deals because our competitors outsmart us. I mean, it's inevitable. And that's why we've got to, you know, we have to look at a lot of deals before we sort of, you know, we'll look at sort of, you know, 25, 30 deals before we sort of find one that we sort of feel like sort of takes shape and size. It's honestly, it's a lot of work. It's a hard job. It's a really hard job.
This deal in specific is just kind of classic case in point. The family that has this property has had it for almost 80 years. So it's gone generation to generation through that family. And we've been working at this the better part of, since probably January is when they put the posting memo together. So this is one of those situations where it's taken a lot of time to build up some level of trust about, you know, here are other people that have done business with this. This is who we are. This is how it works. You know, if we say we're going to do it, we're going to do it. But by the way, we're also going to be very honest about, you've got some challenges at this building, and this is how it's getting priced.
Yeah, when you're buying, doesn't a seller, what does the seller care if you're, as long as they're getting their money, what does it matter?
I think so often, you know, particularly an old building like this where you've got tenants, you know, this concept of a retrade, you know, okay, so now I've had it in contract with you for 2 or 3 months, and after I, you know, then I'm sort of a wise guy at the end. I said, oh, you know what, I didn't know about this and I didn't know about that. I was going to give you 40, but now I'm going to give you 35 million. And
that's,
I said, oh, 35 million. And now you're sort of sitting there. It's like, okay, my buyer at 40 is now 35. And now I got to go back to my second guy. So how do I look in front of the second? Doesn't the second guy knows that something went wrong?
Right.
So the seller sort of has to sort of pick that best horse and hope they perform. Otherwise, when they have to go back to the backup bidder, they look very weak.
Okay.
Don't you see that?
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Into Canal Street.
You can go through these two. I mean, these are just, you know, a couple deals. I think, let me sort of speak to the bottom one, because I think it's a super interesting deal, and then maybe you sort of hit the Canal Street one. The bottom one, you know, we call it a pipeline opportunity too, is funny naming here. But this is really, it's a neighboring site to a project that we've already invested in, all have already invested in. The project that you'll know it, you may have heard of a project called Boynton Yards. It's in an area in a town in Boston right across from Cambridge called Somerville. Obviously, Cambridge is a very important location in Boston. It's sort of the home of these great universities, and, you know, Cambridge, for people who may not focus on what's happening there, they have become the life science epicenter of the world, not like, oh, of Boston. they have become the life science, the research and development, life science epicenter of the entire world is right in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You know, it's Harvard, it's MIT, it's, you know, Mass General, everything that's happening there. And there's some really freaking smart people there. As a result of it becoming the epicenter, it's full. There's no space. The buildings that they do a lot of this research on is they call them laboratory buildings, buildings that are sort of specialty buildings to do this chemical and sort of biological research. The vacancy rate of lab space is less than 1%. No place. What we saw was an opportunity to acquire a fairly large site, literally, I don't know how far is it?
A mile and a quarter.
Mile and a quarter from Cambridge, where we can start to develop sort of, what I'll sort of say, cheaper and available laboratory buildings. And that's what this deal represents. So it's really sort of a focus on sort of what's happening in Cambridge, the strength of the life sciences. And I don't, honestly, it may, you know, people may stop shopping on Amazon or they may stop using, you know, Uber, but I think people are gonna work their butts off for the rest of their lives to cure diseases like cancer and things like that. So I don't ever see that business abating at all. And I think everybody would agree with me. And as a result of that, you know, we sort of felt like there is an opportunity to play off the strength of Cambridge by going into Somerville, by developing, you know, office and laboratory space that one is available and is at probably a 30% discount to Cambridge rents. We have already sort of closed on the first piece of that. We're about to sort of start the development of a laboratory building with old partners or friends and partners called Legamical Properties. In Somerville, that we think will kick off in January, and I'm sure we'll sort of lease it up to a big company very quickly, and then we'll build the subsequent buildings. This represents sort of the second phase of that, which would allow us just to sort of, candidly double down on the strength of that market, and we're super excited about that deal.
Maybe we should. I'll just very quickly. We've got two deals on Canal Street, which is in the North Station section of Boston. It's another neighborhood that we've, at the end of Fund 5, we invested in a small deal called Warren Street, which is just on the other side of the river from this one, and it's a market that we've been tracking as one of the neighborhoods in Boston that just kind of how train lines run and the like, this is a marketplace for a lot of growth.
So anyway, look, I know we're going to, let's sort of bring it to a close. If there's any questions, we're happy to answer any questions. If you have any questions, but again, sort of thank you for having us, and we're certainly excited about sort of moving forward with you, and we're very excited about Fund 6, and we think that, you know, these markets and these opportunities are really sort of extraordinary.
Before you came in, Scott made a comment because we attended your conference and it was done very well.
Oh, great. Yeah, it was nice to have you there, and you should come back to see it. It's really, now that it's open, it's like...
Yeah, the couple really week good. Difference between seeing the building then and now is remarkable.
Yeah, I tell you, we're really into this. I love my job. I've got the best job in the world.
So you're not going anywhere in the next 5 years?
Mind?
You going anywhere?
Not going anywhere, unless somebody else has another plan for me. But yeah, so we're, yeah, things are going well. Great, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thank you
very much.